Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. Please consider becoming a patron. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to Labyrinths ad-free.
Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson to learn more.
One day I saw a newspaper ad looking for sperm donors, and I thought, this seems like easy money. And it wasn't much more involved than that. I did not think about the long-term consequences of that at all.
My name is Jessica Scher, and I met my boyfriend 12 years after I had his baby.
All right.
That's the short version of that story.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this is Labyrinths.
We live in an age of non-traditional families. Single parents, two moms or two dads, polyfamilies, and adoption are all far more common today than ever before. But when Aaron Long and Jessica Scher reached out to us, we encountered a family and a love story that we never could have imagined.
Let's start at the beginning of the story with you deciding one day that you want to have a baby, and gosh darn it, you're going to get one.
I had a partner. My partner was a woman, and I was in graduate school. And when we got together, we both wanted children. And I mean, this was a time when we had a domestic partnership in the town we were in. We had a marriage in Canada. We had pieced together this relationship where we were going to be together and we were going to have a family. And a really great time to do that, if anyone has ever been a graduate student, is when you are writing your dissertation. You have a lot of at-home time. You can work 20 hours a day, but those can be any 20 you want. So we had really a lot of privilege to plan this out.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided we were going to have a baby. I was 28 at that point, and how it worked was we looked online. You know, I was a women's studies professor, so I was like, I don't need this ship to a doctor thing. There's one sperm bank in this country that ships to your home. And I had also taken a law class where I very much learned that I did not want a known donor. There were too many risks at that time of sort of just people coming in and being able to take your toddler from you.
Oh,
and that
God.
Was incredibly scary as a young gay woman, just sort of hearing all those cases. You know, if someone brings your child a tricycle, that means you're allowing them to have a parental relationship with your child and you've just lost custody.
Holy crap.
So all we really knew for sure was we wanted an anonymous donor, and we felt really confident that we could do this at home. It wasn't such a huge deal.
A decade before this, Aaron Long found himself back in his hometown making a living as a taxi driver. He had graduated from Temple University in 1992 with a creative writing degree and had then taught English for a year in the Canary Islands. He was now 28 himself and looking for a little extra cash on the side.
How much did you get paid?
$40 a pop. And you could donate twice a week. I did it for a year. So I think I earned a grand total of about $4,000 from this.
All right.
Now, I once tried to become a sperm donor. I think I've told you this.
And you got rejected.
I got rejected, yeah.
Why did they reject you?
Yeah,
again?
Why did they reject you?
So I was in Boston. I was in grad school doing creative writing. And I think they don't tell you why. What they told me was, when I got rejected after giving my sample, I was like, hey, if there's not something wrong with me, is there? And they said, if there was any medical reason, we'd let you know, right?
So they didn't like your attitude.
Well, honestly, I think what it was is I was in Boston and probably brown-eyed, brown-haired, 5'11" guys majoring in the arts were a dime a dozen or something. I think they were sort of in full stock of guys like me, especially in Boston, like having a high education and good SAT scores and whatever, like did not at all make me stand out among the crowd of donors.
I do remember them saying, you know, if you, you know, were any other ethnicity than white, you could donate three times a week.
Right? Yeah. So you qualified to become a donor. Can you like paint for our audience, what is that office like? What is that space like? And without getting, you know, too graphic, like what is the process of donating like?
So the office was in a kind of generic office building. It wasn't like specifically a medical building or anything. It was two blocks from my house, which was handy. You know, I went in there, I interviewed and filled out some written paperwork. They did blood tests and also some sort of STD test, I think. A typical donating event is you walk into the office, they hand you a little specimen cup with a blue lid. You go into a private room. They have some porn there, just paper. This is 1994. And you masturbate into a cup. You put the lid back on, and then there's like one of those little doors in the wall, like a little slot in the wall to like put your cup and close it up, and then you leave. That's pretty much all there is to it.
So we picked an anonymous sperm bank. We went online. It was 2004. It wasn't complete dark ages. And we really did what you would expect to happen today. We picked a donor, kind of like shopping for shoes out of a catalog.
Yeah, so what information does the catalog give you?
The catalog gives you much less information than you would have today. Today, it's like, what's your astrological sign? Here's 100,000 pictures of you growing up. At the time, you could order like a snippet of 10 seconds of their voice and a number of like kind of weird things that my partner and I were like, this is not even
relevant.
Genetic. Right. You know, what we did have is a very lightweight profile of family history written by someone who'd, you know, do they know what their family history really is? Sure, grandpa has high blood pressure, grandma died of lung cancer. You know, I have a very large extended family, and so there is every disease there. But you kind of try to filter for people who don't say cancer, 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 cancer.
Right.
And that's really about all you can do. And because I was the one that was writing the dissertation and I was a year and a half older, I was going to get pregnant first. We did pick veering toward traits that my partner had to try to match her.
So the plan was that you would both do this eventually.
Eventually.
Yeah.
And she did it next.
Was there anything in particular about the responses of the donor you chose that struck you?
We did a lot of like really snotty judgment based on grammar.
I mean, if it's all you got.
This is what you've got. You're working with what you're working with. And like even at that point, I think you could have like shelled out $10 for baby pictures. And we were like, what on earth is this really going to give us?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just try to match my partner and let's not get 10 cancers in a row. And that's the best we can do. And one thing that seemed really cool to us about Aaron's profile is I remember he said hobbies, games, sports, music. So it's almost like you're not picking the smartest, most focused profile at the sperm bank. You're like, well, this kid can grow up to be anything this kid wants to be. And yeah, we did get pregnant. We started out the journey not so much caring about the donor, wanting a healthy baby, wanting to have our own family, kind of knowing that babies grow into whatever they're going to grow into, regardless of what we do about it. But in the moment that we had our daughter, that was the moment where we were like, yeah, we're going to use the same donor next time. It's perfect. Let's clone it. We love it.
That's awesome. I love that.
Wait, so you did use the same donor for your partner's baby?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so you have babies.
Yay! So we have babies. They're awesome. We love our babies. They are a little me and a little partner. And we spend a lot of years trying to figure out how they're like each other. But they're very clearly like the eldest child who's the small professor and the youngest child who's the gregarious youngest child of a bartender. But you look at them and you're like, wow, I've never even seen a baby picture of this donor. I don't see it. How are they like each other?
Interesting.
Because they were so much, if all you've ever seen is yourself, and you've seen your baby pictures too. You've seen your family growing up. You have these sort of threads in your head of how you look alike. It's really interesting. You do, if they have the same donor, kind of are like, oh, that's me and that's her, but I don't quite get it.
I want to know about having two moms and about how the way that they came into the world differs from how many other procreative acts happen. Did they have questions about that or how did they come to learn that information?
They never had questions because it was on the table from day one.
Hmm.
And I think that when you are a lesbian couple, it has to be. Even when we had our children, there weren't great precedents. You couldn't look online and be like, how to explain this to your child? It was sort of what I grew up with in the 70s, which is like closed adoption, never tell the child anything about their family that is not what it is. We never had the luxury of even considering that.
Mm.
And so it was always sort of like, mommy and mommy loved each other very much, and we wanted to have a family and share that love with you. And babies are made with eggs and sperm, which come from men and women. And so we needed to get some sperm in order to have a baby. And so here's what we did. And I've shown the children what a sperm donation sperm bank website looks like.
Cool.
So they always knew.
Yeah.
My youngest daughter in particular had a lot of questions about siblings, and she knew there was donor sibling registry out there and that sperm donation children could meet.
How old is she when she becomes curious about that?
5, 6, 7. Old enough to know that advertisements come on TV where it's like, I found my long lost siblings.
How did you feel and your partner feel about the whole idea of them finding other siblings?
My partner is incredibly against that, or was at the time. My partner was very adamant that love makes a family, and you don't need to know any of that. But there's a lot of protesting too much in that amount of defensiveness about it. And I felt like if it's not a big deal, then why are we making it such a big deal?
Mm-hmm.
Let's treat it like it's not a big deal. This is genetics and it's not nothing, but it's not everything. I'm not threatened by them knowing who the donor is or who the siblings are. Mm-hmm. They might be close. They might not be close. We didn't have any idea back then. Now, a lot of donor siblings know one another. And there is some sort of precedence that you can look to if you're concerned about that in your family.
So did they go down that route at all with your help or on their own to find if they had donor siblings?
Not at that age, no. We had looked and seen that there were a couple of donor siblings, and we're just sort of explaining to them there might be a few. This was not a world in which if the donor didn't put himself there, you were never ever going to find him.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So that was a whole new part of the conversation that they didn't have when they were little. When they were little, it was just like, yeah, see, look, there's a couple of others there. And they didn't express an interest in emailing these people and exchanging photos at that point. And my partner was very against it, and I was still co-parenting with her. So I wanted to let my kids know, if you want this, this is here for you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're old enough to pursue this on your own, you can.
Was it a point of conflict, like the origin story of conflict between you and your partner?
It wasn't, but my partner was very against the idea of making biology something that was important in our home, and I respected that.
If Jessica and her partner had gone into this process with a lot of care and thought about what it meant to have children through a sperm donor, Aaron went into his side of the process with far more nonchalance.
Like you said, you went into it not thinking the long-term like consequences of it. But as you were there regularly going in, did you think at all like, huh, there's going to be a little person that has my DNA out there in the world potentially?
Sure, I had that thought, and that was totally fine with me. But again, this is 1994. The internet barely exists. And so there was no concept of being able to find these people. Like, I'd signed non-disclosure agreement of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Like, both me and the people buying the sperms had both said we wouldn't try and contact each other, and it would just be anonymous. And that's how I thought it would be. And it wasn't till almost 30 years later that the idea that you could find each other even became a real thing.
When you're donating, what was your general attitude toward procreation for yourself? Like, did you think, I want to have kids one day, or did you know that you didn't? Where were you on that page?
I was not a person who was like, oh, I really want to have kids. But I was very interested in having, you know, romantic partners, getting married.
Okay, so some years go by. Do you find that relationship? Do you get married? Do you have kids in the old-fashioned way at all? Does anything like that happen?
It doesn't. My romantic life until the present was kind of a disaster my whole life. I mean, I would fall in love. I would have these relationships where I thought, you know, this is the person I would be with. And then often, like, to my astonishment, they would just break up with me. And I wasn't expecting it. Maybe I'm sort of a clueless person, but at least three times I thought I had met the person I would marry, and each time it fell apart.
Hmm.
I never like gave up on love. I kept dating people, but I did have a sort of cursed feeling, I would say. Like, I always felt like I was a reasonably good catch, you know, educated. I hold down a job. I'm a little bit unconventional and kind of hippie, but it was always a little mystery to me why it never worked out.
But Aaron wasn't the only one finding himself unlucky in love. Jessica was going through relationship problems of her own.
My partner leaves one day. She took off with my youngest daughter. After like a decade of co-parenting, she decided she was going to ghost our daughter. My daughter from here, her grandparents have ghosted her. Her aunts and uncles, her cousins don't speak to her, don't consider her family.
Whoa.
I don't want that youngest daughter to ever hear anything where she's been replaced and where she's not my daughter.
Mm.
My eldest daughter has gotten that. She's got a blog. She writes her sister every single Friday. My ex, I have zero idea what actually happened here, is kind of why we forget this side of the story. It's not really explainable, but the couple of snippets I know, like something really bad went down. She's not reaching out to us.
Huh.
We're a little scared of whatever's going on in that household. When I had Alice alone, even after just a very short time, she was turning 11. She had just been walked out on. Even Grandma and Pappy decided that love didn't make a family and they were never going to send her a birthday card again. She didn't have any idea that donors or donor siblings or some other DNA family was a part of it, but she did have an idea that there was this new product called 23andMe where she could really find out.
We could give you lots of reasons to support Labyrinths on Patreon, including ad-free episodes and exclusive patron-only content. But why not hear it direct from a listener?
Hi, this is Cannon. I'm a big supporter of the Labyrinths Patreon page because the work that these people do is really thoughtful, and it's one of my favorite podcasts and Patreon accounts in the world.
Visit patreon.com/KnoxRobinson.
So one day you decided you wanted to do 23andMe. What prompted you to do that? Was it just because it was in the style at the time?
When I began to see the ads, it definitely occurred to me, oh, I might be able to find some of my kids. I was definitely curious, but after about a year of seeing these ads, I was like, well, all right, I'll just do it.
And specifically, you were thinking like there'll be hits with people that were the product of my donations.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's my motivation for doing it. Like when you do those tests, you get, you know, genealogical information.
So before these results come back, do you have any inkling like it's going to be 50 hits or maybe it'll be one? You know, what's your...
I had no idea. Like...
I have 100 kids.
Yeah. Were you worried about the number of kids potentially here?
It wasn't until after I got results that I began to like do math about it. But I really had no idea. I had no idea how well my sperm had sold. I also wasn't really aware of the shelf life of sperm. I wasn't sure like if it had all been used like year one or whether it could be used over long periods of time. And then to get hits, both you and the people who are born from your sperm have to have decided to join this specific site. And I just had no idea what the odds were.
So what comes back on that profile? What do you find when you first do it?
So I got exactly one hit.
Hmm. Did it send you a notification? Like, how did you find out?
So, you know, you spit in a tube, you mail it away, they send you back in a couple of weeks, or they email you and say your results are ready. And they don't tell you what to expect. You just log into the site. There's a tab that says DNA relations. You click on that tab, and then what you see is a list of the DNA relations within the site, and they're listed in order of how much percentage DNA you share with those people.
Mm-hmm.
And at the top of the list was 50% Bryce, son.
Wow.
And that was it. There was one hit. And so immediately I wouldn't say it panicked exactly, but my heart began to race. And the thing I didn't know is, like, I was a new user of the site, but would they send him a message saying, your dad just joined the site?
Yeah, you know?
It turns out they don't do it like that. They do send you an email periodically saying you have new DNA relatives, but they don't just like ping you the second.
Did it say anything about Bryce on that page?
Not much. They had a name, and it turned out the name he put in was partially fake. And I think it gives an age, but it doesn't tell you where they are. And you can examine a comparison between your DNA and their DNA as to, like, ancestry kind of stuff.
And is there a big glowing, like, message Bryce button?
There is.
Yeah.
It's not glowing, but there is a way to communicate with him. And so, again, I was thinking maybe he'd been pinged, so I felt some pressure to message him pretty quickly because I didn't want him thinking I'd logged in and didn't want to message him. But of course, the first thing you do when you see a name of someone you're interested in is you Google the crap out of it. I actually enlisted some help on this. One of my friends is an NPR reporter, so I gave her the name and said, you know, go to it. And we found two people who it was possible it was, and it was a kind of unusual name. And again, it wasn't exactly the right name, but somehow we were still able to find it. And one of them looked just like me.
How emotionally invested or connected to this person did you feel? Did any part of you think, my son?
It definitely wasn't a feeling like my son.
Like my long lost progeny.
Yeah, it wasn't that feeling. But, you know, I was super interested, you know, make no doubt about that. I was keenly interested in this person and wanted to contact them. Most of my feeling in this whole story is just like, how cool is this?
Like, wow, whoever would have thought technology would allow me to one day find Bryce?
Right.
I took a couple days thinking about what to say to him and wrote up a brief personal history. Eventually, I wrote like a 50-page personal biography.
Oh, wow.
But at first, I wrote something that was like, you know, three paragraphs. And I sent it to Bryce. I sent it at like midnight Seattle time, I think in part because I was just hoping to get something back maybe the next day, like maybe 15 minutes later.
Oh, wow.
And it's like 3 a.m. on the East Coast. I get a message back from Bryce. And this message begins, Dad! Exclamation point. And that definitely made me go, erp.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, what is he expecting from me? You know, because suddenly there's...
Where have you been?
The use of the word dad is charged, of course. And, you know, I just wondered what his expectations of me were going to be. Like, was he going to show up on my doorstep and have expectations that I suddenly become his dad?
Yeah, you got to throw the old pigskin around now, I guess.
It turned out he didn't have any expectations, but of course he was curious, and he was happy to hear from me and wanted to connect. And one of the first things Bryce let me know was that he was in contact with a number of his sperm siblings.
That's what they call themselves?
The terminology is really hard. I've seen the word diblings, like donor siblings.
Donor siblings, okay.
There's not a lot of agreement on how to do this.
I like diblings. That sounds cute.
Better than sperm sisters.
Yeah. Yeah, throwing the word sperm in there always makes things like a little... So immediately I go from having one to having six.
He was in touch with five others.
Yeah, so there's this other way you can do this. And I had investigated this before on the internet, this thing called the donor sibling registry. So when you buy sperm, you don't get my name, but you do get my donor number. You know, everyone who buys my sperm gets that same donor number. And so the donor sibling registry was a place on the internet where children or perhaps their parents could go and register their donor number and find other people who had that same donor.
How long into the conversation with Bryce does this information drop?
Oh, immediately. His first reply, he's like, you know, Dad, I'm so excited to hear from you. I thought I'd let you know I've been in contact with five of your other children.
So within 15 minutes of sending that message, you've got six kids.
Yeah.
A half dozen. Okay. Did that make you want to reach out to those other?
Yeah. So I told Bryce, please let the ones you're in contact with know that I would be happy to be in contact with them and pass along my email address. Bryce at the time, I think, was 19 or 20. And he said, well, one of them is also my age, Madeline. And he got me in touch with her right away.
Bryce and Madeline weren't the only ones making efforts to connect with their donor dad. Jessica's daughter, Alice, age 11, had also expressed interest in learning more about her ancestry.
She asked Grandma, who readily agreed to help with this project, for a DNA kit for Christmas. And my mom jumped all over that and got it for her.
And were you in support of this also?
I'm totally in support of that. And actually, I didn't even have to think it through because I had no idea that when the results came back, you'd click on DNA relatives and the very first thing that comes up is, you know, father, 50% shared. Maybe I should have thought ahead that far, but this is now 7-8 years ago. And, you know, what are the chances that he's there? What are the chances that anybody's there?
So she takes the DNA kit. It shows who her dad is. Thoughts?
Thoughts are like, oh, holy shit. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to deal with this right now. I better start thinking now. And I better start Googling right now, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he has a common enough name that there are quite a few of them out there. The part of the original insemination story that you did not hear is one of those 8, 9, 10 months that we were purchasing sperm for both of our girls with this donor. One of those months, I got a vial that said 1994.
Hmm.
Very interesting, right? Because now this is someone who has a master's degree by 1994, but is still young enough to donate sperm. So now I have an idea of how old this person is. I have an idea of where they donated sperm based on the bank.
Doing a little Sherlock Holmesing here.
I'm a researcher and I'm very good at this. So within an hour, I had who I thought was the correct person on LinkedIn. His LinkedIn picture is he's wearing a turban and he's playing a trombone.
Ah.
And I can't see his face at all, and he's a 50-year-old man. I'm like, I have no idea if this is the one. But I think it is, because look at the name of his college right in that town by that sperm bank. Look at his master's in creative writing, which is what we matched to my partner. Look at his brown curly hair, which we matched to my partner. And so using his city and his workplace, I found him on Facebook, and he had his K-12 school pictures every single year in a row. I had goosebumps immediately. There was no questioning it. Him in first grade was my eldest daughter with a bowl cut looking like a 60s boy. I was terrified, actually, that there was some sort of notification that 23andMe sends out.
Mm.
You've got a really important relative now.
Mm-hmm.
Blinking signs, warning. And the clock is ticking and I'm not writing him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's telling him something. And so I really felt like I had to reach out to him really quickly. I had to make that decision really quickly because I don't know what the rules of politeness are in this situation at all.
And is that what your daughter wanted? Or did you have a chance, you get the results and did she say, I want to talk to him? Or
she didn't say, I do want to talk to him. She didn't say, I don't want to talk to him. I mean, he's obviously put himself on a DNA website knowing he donated sperm.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a sign that he's open to a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still the wall that is standing in between him and my daughter mitigating this. So I felt like, you know, I should say, hey, you match my kids. There's actually another one. You mm-hmm. should probably know that. What are you looking for? What do you want to know about us? What do we want to know about you? And that's sort of what I did.
I got a message. And at first I was confused because I thought the message was coming from Alice, but really it was her mother, Jessica, writing. And Jessica's message was also a little confusing because she mentioned two children, even though I only saw one on the site. And it took a little bit of back and forth to figure out what was going on. But it turned out that Jess and Alice lived in Eugene, which is not terribly far away. And at the time I was living in Seattle. But being in touch with Jess, you know, it was very different than being in touch with the kids because, mm-hmm. She was an adult. She had bought my sperm. And honestly, we just clicked right away. We didn't talk on the phone for a really long time, but we just had like a chat going. And
by clicked, what does that feel like to you? Were you surprised that you had such a connection with her? Was there a flutter? Like, talk to me about this clicking.
Well, I mean, it happened in a couple of ways. First, I did see pictures of her, and she is super cute. So I definitely noted that. But she was also of a kind of similar mindset. You know, we both had academic backgrounds and were analytical. And so we both began to just like approach this interesting situation we had found ourselves in, and the idea of how many kids were out there, and just exploring the whole process of donating and buying sperm. The way we thought about it was very similar. And so we had really interesting conversations that flowed back and forth very easily.
This is all text, though.
Yeah, it's all text.
So are you feeling like maybe there's romance here? Or is it like, this might be a really good friend? Where are you on that spectrum during this text phase?
I'm interested. Another way we connected was Jess had been living with two of my donor children, hers and her partner at the time. And so she had been with those childs and knew their mannerisms and personality traits. And so, sure, of course, she was comparing those to me, what she could pick up from our text conversations. And also she would look at the pictures, like, you know, she sent me photos of the kids from all these ages. And eventually I, you know, shared a lot of photos of me as a kid. There's a couple of photos, one of Alice and one of me at around 10 years old, where we are like twins. I think that gave her a strong predisposition to have some sort of attraction to me. I look like her kid. You know, I'm very familiar. I was interested, definitely. And at some point, I just expressed this to her. I wasn't shy about it.
Still in the text phase?
Yeah, still in the text phase.
Oh, how did that moment go?
I do remember her response, where she said she appreciated that, but that she was dating someone and was in love with them. And so I dropped it.
Was this her partner or someone else?
This was someone else.
Okay.
She and her partner had broken up.
Was there a hope in those conversations that you would also meet her partner's kid as well, her second kid?
No, because the tragedy in that situation had already happened. You know, I do want to meet all of my donor children, but she told me that story. It wasn't on the table as a thing that might really happen.
Because she had mentioned there were two kids at the very beginning, and it sounds like through the process of talking to each other, you might have the chance of meeting one of them. But what did it feel like for you to learn that meeting the other one was off the table?
At first, it made me a little wary of Jess, honestly, because I thought if this other person had withdrawn their other daughter completely from Jess, they might have had cause for that.
Sure.
You know, so there might be something I need to be wary about with Jess. You know, that idea got dispelled reasonably quickly. Again, I just kept interacting with Jess, and there was just no sign of any, like, she's just not a crazy person.
It went back and forth a few times before we talked about, especially with my daughter, do you want to meet? Do you want to have a relationship? What's your ideal look like for your relationship with this person? Because I didn't feel like I had a relationship with this person. I felt like it was my kid's relationship with this person. And I'm here to do what you want, or at least I'm here to kind of stand in the way of that till you're 18.
I think the first time I talked to her on the phone was we had decided finally to get together in person, and I just needed to have a logistics conversation. When I called her on the phone, it immediately rekindled my romantic interest. I called her on the phone, and she said, Alice, I'm going outside for a while. So she wanted to talk to me privately. And I was like, oh, maybe that's just a natural thing to do. But she went for a walk to talk to me.
Yeah, I guess my one question that is sitting with me still is, it seems like the interest in doing a 23andMe on your daughter's side really arose in response to losing her family in a big way.
That was a huge part of my hesitation, of especially like conversations about meeting Aaron. We had never talked about the sperm donor as a father. No, I don't think any lesbian couples would or did. But as we felt it out, I will tell you, my daughter's sense of loss was one of the final deciding factors of why I decided it was okay for her at this age to meet him, because she really didn't want more parents to let her down. She was not, oh my God, why isn't he coming to daddy-daughter donut day with me?
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't he love me? Why doesn't he want me? She didn't really want that. She was not going to just leap into his arms like an innocent 11-year-old expecting him to parent her. And I kind of thought that was a healthier place to come to, you know, sort of sitting down and having a smoothie with the guy and finding out what he likes, him finding out what you like, and, you know, maybe leaving it there for a few years if we wanted to. I thought that she actually was in a pretty good position to take whatever came.
What was the vibe you got from the texting back and forth?
I was doing a lot of mom thinking in my head the entire time. What is okay? What do we want to do? What do I need him to know vis-a-vis both my kids? I'm thinking about my kids.
All right. Well, he clearly had more flirtatious thoughts in mind.
Well, at some point, he made those thoughts expressly clear. How do you react to that?
I don't know him. I feel like you could identify with this as a parent immediately, because the answer is absolutely not. This is bad mommy 101. The absolute stupidest thing that a bad mommy could do would be to get involved in this relationship and blow it up for your children.
Hell yeah.
I am not interested in that in any way, shape, or form. And I'm with someone, so it's sort of a nice excuse. And I've never met you. I did not think much of it. I was like, oh, that's sweet. You're nice. Bye.
Rejected. But you kept talking.
Mm-hmm.
And you decided to meet up. And what was that conversation like?
So it was in the context of not just meeting Alice and Jess. Bryce and Maddie had expressed interest, and they were both on the East Coast. And my personal situation at the time was I was the primary caregiver for my elderly mother. And so it was hard for me to go anywhere. So it was going to be easier if everyone came to me. Summer was good because Bryce and Maddie would be out of school. And so we just picked a date in the summer, invited them to come out. Jess and Alice would drive up. My brother was going to come too. Of course, he was curious about it. He was now an uncle for the first time in his life.
Let me pause you for a second there. Having the big group like that, is it more or less intimidating walking into that situation than if it was just Alice and Jess?
Less, for sure.
Same for you, Jess?
Absolutely, because I'm not thinking of me at all. I'm thinking of Alice. And I think that, you know, here's a couple of siblings and the donor is a real pressure off situation. They can talk amongst themselves if you want. You can look at them. You can say hi to all of them. We can go back home. And then from there, it can be whatever you want it to be. I really liked the idea of meeting everyone in a group.
How is Alice feeling?
Alice is a very take it or leave it kind of kid. She was not attributing huge things to it. She was fine with it.
Mm-hmm.
I was the one that was like, is this okay? Should we be doing this? Let me Google it. Oh, there's nothing. So I was the one that was kind of having to come up with the rules about what was okay and what was not okay. And I didn't know if it was going to be okay with her forever, right? Like sometimes your 11-year-old is acting cool about things and doesn't think it's a big deal to them now, but that doesn't mean it won't be a big deal for them 5 years from now. So I was just trying to keep it light. It is what it is. It's handy to know these might be good people, good to have in our back pocket. Let's go see.
Of course, we added our own pressure to the situation because, you know, I had revealed to some people this interesting occurrence in my life.
He gave a PowerPoint at a talent show.
Wait, what?
He lived in a co-op building. So there were like 20 people there. And there was one night when it was like talent night. He stood up with a PowerPoint announcing that he had, you know, multiple sperm donation children because he wanted like the shock value, right? And it was hilarious and he wanted the laughs. And everyone in the building was like, oh, my God, Aaron, who we've known for 10 years, is a single guy, has 70 children, and they're all coming here. Wow.
And so in the course of revealing this to people I lived with and friends, one of them was like, hey, would you be interested in having a documentary movie made about this? And I was like, yeah, I'd be interested in that, but I've got to run it by these other people.
Yeah.
And so I ran it by Jess and Alice and Bryce and Maddie, and they were all cool with it. But it did sort of add a layer to our first meeting, because of course the documentary makers wanted to film us meeting for the first time.
That was weird.
Okay, so what was the setting?
I lived in this co-op. It is not the co-op in the sort of New York sense of a co-op building. It was kind of like living in a dorm for adults. And so this event of the filming and the meeting took place in a lounge in this building.
The weird part of how this meeting took place was that the filmmakers had set up a big couch in a very large room for everyone to meet. So
yeah, we're sitting in a row. We can't even really like look at each other.
Like, how do you feel meeting this person? And they're all just like, I don't know yet.
I'm meeting you, the filmmaker.
I'm like behind a camera.
Yeah, Jess
like,
is behind the camera.
Taking some pictures going, I think my kid will appreciate this one day.
Oh gosh, that sounds horrible.
But it was not any kind of ideal way to get to know people, right? Like they just wanted to talk to each other. They didn't know the answers to the questions they were being asked yet.
I mean, later on, there was
an party tricks.
Open it up for questions. My friend Tim Kreider, who's an artist, made us these cute signs that each had a caricature of us on them. And one side was a yes face and yes word. And the other side was a no face and no word. And then they would ask us a question. And we had to flash our answer.
Are you afraid of snakes? Do you like roller coasters? And that was a little fun and interesting because it kind of was a unique situation in that you have these three different kids who were raised completely differently, and you have the sperm donor. Like, to what extent do they turn out at all the same? They all hate math, and none of them believe in God. That is what is genetic, we have learned.
So you have this kind of awkward filmed first meeting. How do you disperse from that?
We decided to all stay in the co-op in various rooms and camp out. And we decided to go on a 2-week vacation with each other, all to Eugene, to go to Oregon Country Fair. So Aaron was sort of giving them the tour of who he is in his life.
All right. So potentially an awkward start, but you have 2 weeks to really like get to know each other. That's nice.
That was easier. And that was more fun.
Yeah. The film crew was there for the first couple of days. We had the initial meeting, and then the next day we had a party called the Meet My Kids Party. And I had friends even come from out of town to it. And, you know, it was a pretty big party, pretty fun.
How did you feel about that, Alice being referred to as his kid?
I was half okay with it.
Okay.
No one was really like, and this is your father, and you are his child. And she would have set them straight if they tried. She is more adamantly against that. One of my bigger fears would have been like, here's you and a 55-year-old man, have something in common, have a conversation.
Right.
That would have been too much pressure for her. So he had friends there with kids, and that was cool for her.
Did you guys find yourselves talking amongst each other, or were you mostly keeping an eye on Alice?
We definitely very quickly, even before we ditched the film crew, right? And we needed to ditch the film crew. It was much better when we got rid of them. We had a lot more in common than I think we knew. Like we had done all this sort of logistical. I had done all this, like, should the kids meet? How should the kids meet? I had more needs than Bryce and Maddie, who were just college. They were on their own. And I think how I'd always expected things like this to go, like the only understanding I had of this was adult adoptees. They go off. They find their birth parents. They have a meeting with their birth parents. I'd never expected to be involved in this. So the amount of sort of planning I did around this vacation and around this meeting was with him. And then when we even had that party and then when we went on that vacation, we were very quickly just like the mom and dad, if not in name. We're like, all right, there's logistics.
Yeah, we're in the front seat of the car. The kids are in the back seat of the car.
Yeah, I'm like tossing snacks.
Yeah.
You know, just suddenly we're in that role.
That's interesting.
And it was really comfortable and easy to be in.
You know, we had to decide what things to do, where to stop on the highway to eat.
So it sounds like you fell into co-parenting almost before there was any notion of direct romantic connection between the two of you.
So how this works from my perspective is I have just spent a decade watching his mannerisms. This is the opposite of normal parenting. With normal parenting, you find a person and you get to know their mannerisms over time. And then once you know them, you say to this person, let's have little us's. They will look like us and they will act like us. And we want that. It's going to be adorable. I had the little us's for a decade. And so when I met him, I don't know if it's inevitable. I feel very comfortable with him. I know him. I know how he moves. I know how he acts. Meeting him in person was a really different experience for me because you can't get that from the photos. It was like being with people that you haven't seen in a long time and you just pick right back up with.
Did you feel anything like that toward Bryce and Maddie? Did you see a sibling connection? Did you see something shared with them and Alice?
A little bit. I see it more with some of the other siblings. And what's interesting is even to this day, I've met the most kids because I've met my other daughter that none of them have met.
We should say here that the current count is 21 children.
We have a spreadsheet.
Wow. And when was the most recent addition?
A year ago, maybe even less.
Wow.
There are always new people popping up on the ancestry sites.
Wow. Okay. Well, then any noteworthy stories from this vacation?
Like, the vacation was great. Like, we visited friends. We had fun. One notable thing happened on the vacation, which impelled us towards each other. On that very first day when we were having the filming, there was a break in the filming, and we like went off to go to the bathroom, and I ran into Jess in the hall. And we hugged, and I was like, she's interested in me now.
It was just a hug.
What made you think that?
This was not the sort of hug you would just give a stranger.
This was just a hug.
All right.
So we go on this vacation. We're mom and dad.
You're thinking about that hug for days.
We did go on what I think probably in retrospect should be referred to as a first date.
In a cemetery.
In a cemetery. Because I have an 11-year-old. I don't know. She's like only been alone like once. And there's these teens there with her. But like Bryce is on Tinder and just going off in Eugene meeting people. I don't know these kids. So we just took a walk around the neighborhood. And so we ended up in the cemetery. It was a little like high school. You're like, well, we have no car. We just kind of want to stick close to home. And we wanted to talk sort of as adults. But it was an odd first date because it was mostly like me explaining his children to him. I'm filling him in on this world that's a lot more complicated from my side. And we're all here just thinking and talking about like the sperm donation issue of it and the like, what do you have in common side of it? And yeah, we're just all getting to know each other. So it's sort of like, here's what happened the last 10 years with kind of your kids.
What makes it feel first datey to you, that moment?
It's kind of the first time we've been alone together.
Yeah.
Did you hug again?
Yes.
Okay, so what happens next?
Aaron said, well, you know, you could sublet in my co-op because someone's leaving right now. And that almost seemed like at the point at which we were starting a relationship, that other relationship was imploding. It seemed like a really good, almost halfway house to just take some time and figure that out. So let's just hit this pause button and stay here for 3 more months. So we moved to Seattle immediately after meeting him.
I love how you're doing this whole thing like exactly backwards, right?
Yeah.
Right? Because you go from having children to co-parenting to, well, let's be housemates.
Right? Yeah, if we play our cards right, someday we'll just be friends.
Okay, so you move in, co-op life.
How does Alice take to that?
Alice just rolls her eyes. She had been through a really huge trauma. So I think her sort of flippancy and standoffishness was, it was always my biggest concern. And honestly, that meet your kids party at the beginning of this, you know, extravaganza was the biggest part of what convinced me it was okay to possibly start a relationship with him. He had people coming in from Pennsylvania, who he had gone to nursery school with. Not even like K to 12. Here's my friends from high school. But here's Bob from kindergarten. He had like 17 ex-girlfriends because he's never married. He never had kids of his own. He never divorced. He had like every ex-girlfriend he has ever had.
There weren't that many.
Turned out 17 might be me using hyperbole to tell a good story. But every one of them is there. He is still friends with every one of them from nursery school, right? So like the idea that this relationship is going to absolutely explode and I'm never going to see him again and I'm going to screw this up for my kids. And I've even got one kid who's never even met him, never met his elderly mom, might not get to even if they're not interested in the donor. How many people are not interested in grandma? Everybody loves grandma and grandma would love to meet you. And my only real concern here, and it's a huge one, is messing up this relationship for my kids. So when we moved into the co-op, it kind of carried on like that. Like we went backwards into dating phase and we actually got to know each other. And we lived in sort of an extended house situation where Alice and I had this apartment area and I could come down and see him. And at some point that turned into our master bedroom and we just had a very large house with all of these living rooms and kitchens. And it gave us a little bit of distance that I think you need to date someone new when you have a child and start that life.
If not for that co-op, maybe you wouldn't be here today. Together, huh?
Right.
Because if he had been living in a, you know, in a one-bedroom apartment or something, there's no way you're moving in with him.
No,
right?
We wouldn't have.
Wild.
So how long ago was that? And that was 7-8 years ago or something?
Let's see. If she was just 12 that summer, she is a freshman in college now, so 6 years ago.
Just to step back to that time for a minute, one of the things that made me really confident about Jess as a partner was, you know, I was taking care of my mom with Alzheimer's, and Jess was so good with my mom.
Everybody loves grandma.
I mean, my mom is a very sweet person and probably, you know, one of the best case scenarios for someone with Alzheimer's who just kind of kept a sweet disposition. But my mom took to Jess immediately and would just be playful with her. And that gave me a lot of confidence that Jess was a great person.
And ditto, because him caring for his mom like he did 24/7 was amazing.
When did you guys sort of figure out that you were a couple?
We're living together at the co-op. I'm taking care of my mom. Jess begins to help me with that. You know, we just begin doing family things together. Like we begin to have meals together, go on outings together, and you know, we're all together all the time. You know, it's not like I ever asked, do you want to be my girlfriend? It just happened.
I distinctly recall Googling, like, how do I date my child's father? And then realizing really quickly, that's stupid. It's not on Google.
Yeah, maybe this has never happened
to anyone
else. Oh, my
God. Right. This is the only thing I've ever done in my life that nobody's ever done.
We could not find another instance of this.
And how do you, you know, become essentially a step parent to your own biological child?
That's why I'm with Aaron. He had never had kids. He has no idea how to parent. I have a kid who deeply does not want you to come in and try to parent.
Yeah. So talk to us about that. What does it look like today? And were there growing pains along the way? Was there some awkwardness or did it feel like it fit from the very beginning?
I think we've had fewer growing pains than most couples.
Yeah. Jess and I hit it off really well. We're great at working as a team. The prosecution of day-to-day life is just really smooth with Jess. We don't have any conflicts about that. We both have similar, you know, kind of nerdy academic interests. So it wasn't really awkward at all between Jess and I. Between Alice and I, it was a separate matter. One common thing about Alice and I is that, you know, neither of us is especially talkative. I mean, I'm being talkative here with you now, and I can turn it on when I have to, but, you know, you leave Alice and I in a room together, and it's pretty quiet. Alice and I never had any antagonism, which was nice. There was just kind of some distance there. But the one thing I discovered was that Alice has a good sense of humor, and I'm pretty witty. Like, I'll make funny comments about things, and she would laugh. I always felt like I had like won a point when I would get her to laugh, and she would make me laugh sometimes. There was this one time, somehow the word 69 came out, and Alice and I simultaneously said, "Nice." That made me very happy.
Cute.
Alice and Aaron are very similar people. Perhaps that's not random. And they will parallel play like two teenagers. So they're doing similar things next to each other very comfortably all the time. I feel like if he had had a wife and had kids and been divorced and I got with him, the story would be very different because he would have only been able to have a different outlook on other people's teenagers. You know, he just kind of sees her as another introverted friend, as I think he sees all of his donor kids, and he's able to be for them whatever they want. And it's no skin off his back either way, what they want. You know, it doesn't have to be this parental relationship for them. So I think it's a very good relationship, but I think if I dropped dead, it would be interesting to see.
Are there labels? Like, what do you call each other?
That's a tough one. You know, Alice very adamantly does not want me to be referred to as her father. Alice worked at the Thriftway for a while, and sometimes my friends would come in and say, "Oh, Aaron's your dad." And she does not like that at all. And I do my best to get my friends not to use that terminology. I try to avoid using it myself.
But it's really hard.
You know, it's such easy shorthand.
Yeah.
And there's not like a great alternative.
Mom's like, boyfriend who happens to be my biological father.
Right. And it's also become like, I'm trying to give her these lectures. Like she told her doctor on the first appointment, this, I live with my mom and my mom's boyfriend. But that's, it's also kind of a lie. You know, like you're also deliberately misleading in some ways. And I get it. But 2 years into these relationships, people are like, "Hey, Al, I figured something out and you're kind of lying to me." And it's become very weird because you also don't want to have a conversation up front with everyone you meet about, you know, who you are and what your backstory is and why you need to know about this. Here, let me send you a Good Morning America clip so that you understand it. So you put it off and you don't talk about it for a year or two. And then you realize you've got a problem in this friendship because there aren't great words. Using them makes everybody immediately jump to a conclusion that isn't quite accurate.
Because, like, use the word stepdaughter. That's probably the most accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
I think not having those labels, though, also gives you a kind of freedom to build a relationship that's not defined by all the cultural baggage that comes with those labels, right?
So where do you guys see yourself and your relationship and your family unit today? Are you still sort of like on a journey of discovering yourselves, or what is your current situation?
Well, we moved to our house just before COVID, and then we didn't leave it for like 2.5 years. And Alice didn't go to school, and we got a lot of chickens, and 99% of them turned out to be roosters. And so our journey today is just like trying to keep in good graces with our neighbors. And we dropped Alice off at college this fall. And I think we're just going to continue to sit on our couch and watch Jeopardy for another decade.
Eventually, you know, you're just with this person and you have to develop a relationship like anyone else. You know, eventually the origin story begins to fade and we're just two people having a relationship, and it's worked out great. You know, I've never been so happy.
Although you never know, next Tuesday you might have another kid.
Yeah, that's weird. Is that still like a fun part of your relationship? You have that spreadsheet, so clearly you're keeping track.
Interestingly, the first three I met were the most interested in meeting. We've met one other who actually lives locally.
They're great. Alice joined her Girl Scout troop immediately, and they have like a cousin-ish relationship.
Cool.
Why do you think this story draws people in? Lots of people have expressed interest in talking to you about this. Like, why does it matter to people? Does it matter to them for the same reasons it matters to you?
For one thing, it is unique. Like, we don't know of any other instances of this having happened to anyone.
The oddest thing that's ever happened in my life is the time I Googled something that no one else had ever done. Is there no other person that I could talk to that might understand? And I think that that aspect of it is probably what makes it like, hey, we'll do a story on you. But for me, that was a weird, hard parenting decision. I make quite a few of those. And I have to figure out how we're going to do this, knowing my kids and knowing myself and knowing our lives. I think people have liked our story because it came out right before the Golden State Killer, right? At the time at which everybody is going online to these ancestry sites. And quite a few people are finding something new there that is newsworthy that we never thought we'd get 20 years ago.
To address your question of why the public is interested in it, the public is famously suckers for cute stories.
Yeah.
And that's as far as the discussion goes.
The average, like, news story, you know,
is so confusing.
It's often like 2 minutes.
You can't even follow all these people and where they've come from, right?
We'll try and describe our story in 2 minutes in a coherent way. Most of them fail. Once in a while, we'll get radio or podcasts have actually been our favorite way to talk to people. Before this, probably the best experience we had telling our story was with the BBC, who did like a 45-minute conversation with us. But trying to distill our story and just have cute pictures of us,
it also maybe leaves off some of the more difficult or dark spots, I'd imagine.
None of them want to address Soren.
And they do so for legal reasons, which is the part that pisses me off. Because you'd rather protect yourself than this child who's currently living in a like a captive situation. No truth here because we can't get that side of the story, so we might get sued. The only people who have really done 100% truth is Daily Mail.
Oh, wow.
Right? Like, if you watch that Daily Mail piece, there's not a factual error in that. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, like the Seattle Times reporter who interviewed us, you know, I told him, everyone gets it wrong. Everyone screws it up. Please let me just review the copy. I won't, like, try and edit it in any way. Just let me do a fact check. And he was like, no. And he got some stuff wrong.
What about Soren's side of this story do you want told?
I want Soren to know that nobody's replaced her. We don't have a family that is not her. She is our family. She is the love story of this story.
How so?
I think that any kid at 10 who has a family, that's their family and that's going to be their family forever. I do media because I want Soren to hear from us. I want to be out there everywhere. I want that for Alice and I want that for Soren. I want no other child to ever be in the position that she's in now and has been for years. I want more voices to care about my child, of course, my child in trouble. I have to make sure that this child as an adult can trust. She's in a worse position than Alice in a lot of ways, and that Alice is with a parent who she knows isn't going to leave her for anything, isn't going to stop loving her for anything. She knows she can screw up pretty bad. And my other daughter doesn't know that because my other daughter has seen her mom walk out on a child. And so that child is in a much more vulnerable position. And at some point, that child may also know that she's obviously gotten there through some manner of manipulation, whatever that may be. And so the mom that's been telling me she's keeping me safe hasn't been. That's a child that's in trouble of not embracing new people, new family, new loves, and not having a fulfilling life because of it. So I want her to know she's got a family. It's here. It's not leaving you. It will always be here. Whenever you're ready, if you're ready. The takeaway from the story for me is that truth is never scary and bad. Don't be afraid of what you're going to find on 23andMe. There's no blocking it at this point. We can know so many things that we couldn't know 10 years ago. We can find people that don't want to be found. If Aaron hadn't been on that site, I now know I could have found out who it was. I would like to push society to be a little cooler with that, even if what they're finding isn't their favorite, that there's just some sort of value in truth in and of itself. And I want that for Soren.
Did you let them know that you have a website for Soren and that Alice writes
to Soren? I did. I think I said
day?
That Alice writes on her blog. It's a place of communication, even if she can't always get communication in the ways that we want her to have.
Yeah. Does Alice feel a little like she's throwing out a message in a bottle with those, with that blog?
Yes, every Friday. And it's heartbreaking. I've only read a few of them because it's heartbreaking. But it's important that it exists. It's important for other kids that it exists. I like that that's out there publicly. that you can look at that sort of pain and that family and be like, wow, but that would be a good family to have because there's an incredible amount of love there. And I can tell from that pain.
Do you know if Soren is seeing it?
Not definitively. We have some evidence that Soren is keeping up with us a little bit.
Gosh, that's rough.
It is.
All right. Well, do you have any further questions or do you have any further thoughts about that?
We just keep doing it. I'm going to parent every day because that's just what you do. But yeah, I mean, I have sort of come to terms with the idea that even though I'm in a good relationship, I'm also in an abusive relationship and it's an ongoing abuse because every day I know my child's held, lied to, hurt, has lost so much they didn't have to lose. Every time somebody dies that they didn't get to see again or that they never got to meet, like Aaron's mom. Hmm. She would have loved Aaron's mom. She would have loved to have been on a documentary. And so there's an amount of loss there, but there's also just an ongoing parenting journey that I'm going to be on until my kids aren't here anymore because you can't turn it off.
Well, thank you so much for sharing the light and the dark of all of this with us.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a real pleasure.
And thank you for listening.
Stay tuned for next week, where we'll have another installment of Who's Right, our series of serious and silly debates. In the meantime, get lost with us. Find us on Instagram, at AmamaKnox.
At MC Carbon, E-M-C-E-E Carbon.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at knoxrobinson.com. And if you'd like to spread the seeds of labyrinths, please consider donating a 5-star review to Apple Podcasts.
Labyrinths is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us. Our managing producer is Andre Sapp. Our production assistant is Jasper Merrill. And our theme music is by Josh Budo Karp.
Fun fact, for every hour of Labyrinths you enjoy, we put in dozens of hours researching, outreaching, interviewing, scripting, editing, and audio engineering.
What keeps us going?
Coffee. So if you're enjoying Labyrinths, please buy us a coffee.
Head over to patreon.com/KnoxRobinson, where you can make a monthly donation.
Thanks for getting lost with us.